Okay. So, thank you very much for the invitation to speak and for the wonderful conference. I'm sure I speak for everybody when I say that we've had a very exciting and interesting time. What I want to talk about today is perhaps not the best title and topic for the last talk of the conference, because it's in some sense a serious piece of analysis. Everybody I hear here, I guess everybody here knows that I'm sort of pretty enthusiastic about something strange called rough paths, and I thought it might be constructive to try and explain not so much what they are, because I've done that before, but to give a very concrete application of them to a particular problem that I guess most of you are familiar with. And the feature that comes out when you try and apply these things is it normally translates some fairly well-known big problem about stochastic differential equations into a very precise, concrete problem about Brownian motion. And generally, the problem doesn't go away at that point. It gets translated. And so you're faced with a specific, concrete issue to sort. And that's what I want to tell you today. So by the time I get into sorting it, it'll get a little bit technical. But still, I hope you'll find it interesting. We're not the first people to... So this is joint work with Peter Frizz, who's a student of Faraday, who's going to Cambridge in England, and Dan Strook, who doesn't need much introduction. Other people have used the rough path stuff before to get new proofs of the support theorems, but I think what I'm going to talk about is a little bit simpler, a little bit more direct. So, as that picture was running before we started, I'm really interested in a very simple situation where you have some sort of path in a vector space, and it exerts an influence or a control on the evolution of some nonlinear system. In this case, the state was the rotation, the element of O3. And as you roll the sphere along the path, of course, its state changes. And we saw it happening before the talk. Now, one can model this sort of evolution using differential equations, and I've written one down at the bottom there. Basically, what we have here is a very simple system. We have a couple of linear maps into the Lie algebra of rotations. If we go due north, then of course we rotate in one direction. If we go due east or due west, we rotate in another. And infinitesimally, those produce vector fields on the group of rotations. And so we can express, and I think this might be a bit low, but I don't know that there's much I can do about it. We can express this as a differential equation of the following kind. It's a control theory type of differential equation, and we can always think of gamma as a control and y as the sort of response or evolution of a system. But in general, control theorists don't write it like this, and I think I probably make a bit of a mistake, because what they tend to think of is a vector field that you change, you parameterize and change. And the trouble is with that is that it actually needs this object to make sense. It needs both this thing to be differentiable. And the advantage of writing it this way, which of course probabilists understand very well, is that the inputs and outputs are somehow in the same class. We're not starting with a derivative and producing a function. We're not integrating. We're starting with a path and we're producing a path. And so there's some scope, maybe, that if this one gets rougher in the right of the way, that one can get rougher and we don't need to look too closely at what goes on in the meantime. So this is a basic sort of problem that I've been very interested in. And the main thing I'm interested in, which I sort of hinted at, is understanding this map that takes you from the control to the response. Now this map is a surprisingly rich map once the control is no longer one-dimensional. If you want to understand why one dimension is simple, just think of trains versus cars. Trains go back and forwards along a linear system, and the only control really is the backwards and forwards lever. A car, on the other hand, has a two dimensions of degrees of freedom and can go anywhere, and there are infinitely many real outcomes of what happens, including driving off the road and so on. So one dimension is trivial, and I'm not going to talk about it. That's why this path is a two-dimensional path. Two dimensions is already about as, in some sense, as difficult as it gets. And my real interest is in trying to make sense of this when all of these paths are no longer differentiable and smooth, moving away from classical calculus. But today I want to focus on a very specific problem, that's what I said, which is the support theorem. And the support theorem is a theorem in probability theory. What I said before wasn't really to do with probability theory. And it looks at this functional, this E-turf functional, where we start with, say, some path in the Cameron-Martin space, some relatively smooth path where everything has good meaning. And we look at its, the response of the system after solving the differential equation. And now we introduce some probability theory. So we don't just look at this differential equation for the deterministic gamma. We also look at it with a Strzelnowitz integral there for Brownian motion. And what we would like intuitively, and that of course is the content of the support theorem, is a theorem of the form that says if we restrain ourselves, if we can, condition our process to lie within an epsilon of our smooth path, then we would like to prove that the solution to the stochastic differential equation was close to y. If we did that, then for example, since it's pretty obvious that if we take a smooth path, we can get close to it with the Brownian path, we would prove the support theorem, we would show that the solutions to the SDE, and hence the solutions to the PDE, etc., actually got to every neighborhood of our pathway thing, and so on. But the heart of it, and this is the sort of question I'm interested in, is to prove that if you condition to be close to gamma, then the solution should be close to y. Seems a very intuitive idea, but it's actually much more subtle than it seems. And one of the reasons it's subtle is because Brownian paths don't like staying near two paths. It's a very, very small probability set indeed to stay within epsilon of that path. So I'm not only is it very small, it's so small that if I condition it to stay it near it in a different sense, if I use different notions of what I mean by distance here, it's in a finite dimensional vector space, so I could use different norms on Rn, then there's nothing much in common between those sets in terms of probability. They've both got measure e to the minus 1 over epsilon squared or something, but the intersection of them is also very small. So the paths of the conditions to lie inside one ball aren't much like the paths conditioned to stay inside another. You can't switch from one norm to another. It looks intuitive that it wouldn't matter which norm. Use equivalent norms, you get the same answer. This is wrong. When you sit down and think about it, you realize it matters a lot. Well, it turns out that this E-turf function is not too bad, and it has some continuity, at least when we restrict it to smooth paths. And this is really the idea that allows you to make sense of it deterministically when you have nasty paths. The fact is that we won't go into these metrics yet, but later on we will, because it'll be the part of our concrete question which we'll answer. But there are reasonable metrics for each p, and as p gets bigger, the metrics are now rougher and rougher paths, so that if our paths, smooth paths, converge to our original path in this metric, then the responses of the systems converge as well. And actually this has practical implications in sort of engineering problems as well as just in mathematical contexts. But anyway, there are such metrics. They're not much use to you in the probabilistic context until p is bigger than 2, because the distance of a Brownian path from any path would be infinity if p was less than 2. But there's this whole graded family of metrics, and the nice thing about them, I suppose the thing that's important when you sit down and prove these estimates, is that the estimates are uniform. You know, you could, if you really wanted to, make them quantitative, and the error's quantitative. So in particular, if you have a uniformly continuous function, you can always extend it to a completion. You have to be a little bit careful about what it's uniform with respect to, but there are large spaces you can extend it to. And these are really what one would call rough paths. Rough paths are simply the completion, in some sense, of the smooth paths. Okay, so you would know how to make sense of solutions in that case. But coming back to our problem of support theorems, it's obviously going to be enough to prove something like this. I have my Brownian path and I conditioned it to be close to gamma in the uniform norm. That was the statement of the support theorem. If I can prove that with high probability it's close in this metric, then because we know the E-turf function is continuous, then we will be able to conclude that the the y associated with RB is close to the y associated with gamma. If we have a uniformly continuous function and we're interested in the two images being close, it's enough to see that the two points in the domain are close. Right? So it's really enough to simply prove this statement here, that if we take a Brownian path and we condition it to stay close to our path gamma in the uniform norm, then in fact it's with high probability close in whichever metric I haven't yet told you about. And that's a very sort of straightforward statement, but it makes my point that we've moved away from looking at the stochastic differential equation, and now we just have a statement about these two metrics, and I can make this metric very explicit for you in a little while. But before I do, there's one extra simplification that you'll understand, and that is that we don't have it close to a path gamma. We make a change of measure. Gamma was in the Kammer-Martin space, so we just consider the case where it's close to zero. It's a lot easier. So then we have this problem down here. We would like to show that the rough path metric goes to zero in probability if the uniform, then we condition on the uniform norm of the path being small. So that's the goal, but I've got to tell you a lot about what these metrics are and all the rest of it, and then I hope to explain to you the proof. So, what is the idea of these metrics? The idea of these metrics is really to do numerical analysis. You see, I showed you that path before I came in, and it's a very complex path, and I'm rolling the sphere along it. And if I have enough information about it, it would actually piecewise linear. And so there's no question about there being a well-defined solution to what happens. But if I'm a numerical analyst, the last thing I want to do is go along millions and millions of little steps if I can find some better way to summarize the document, the path. And in fact, when I talk about summarizing a document here, I'm not being stupid, because if you take an ordinary text, you can think of that as a path. You can also, when you read a text, think of our response as being the response of a complex nonlinear system to this path. And if you think about it, we are taught at school how to precede these things, how to take a long passage and write a smaller passage, which broadly has the same effect. And although that's a much higher level operation than ours, we should surely be able to do the same thing for our rather boring piecewise linear path on Rn. So our goal is to find an effective way to precede this path, to give us enough information about the individual segments in it that we don't need much more. And the simplest case is where gamma is smooth. And the idea of a smooth path, although you may not have thought about it like that, is that on very small timescales, all of the directions are pointing in the same direction. All the tangents are roughly in the same direction. So it doesn't much matter if you shuffle their order. If you thought about it, you broke up a smooth path and you took the little increments and you shuffled their order, it's in the nature of smoothness that it doesn't have much effect on that differential equation. You can prove it doesn't. What that really means is a good summary of that little bit of path is abelian. We only need to count the number of letters or the words. We don't need to know their order. A smooth path is a path where the order of the increments on small scales doesn't matter. A smooth path can therefore be summarized by its chords over small scales. That is what a chord is. It's an element of Rn, summarizing the path by saying, I don't know what order the increments happen, let's just add them all up. You probably didn't think of it like that, but that's what it is. So for smooth path, chords do just fine, and they do just fine, actually, until the path has roughly holder one half. But as it gets more complicated, it's not a good enough summary, and order really matters. If I go that way around the two sides of a square, or that way, then the effect is really different. And if on smaller and smaller scales you keep on seeing things like that, because it's a bit fractal, it is really not good enough to ignore the order of the increment, the bits, and replace this by an increment. So instead what you do is you replace it by an element of a nilpotent group. And the degree of the nilpotent group depends on the roughness of the path. So for p less than 2, the chord is really good enough, the abelian case. For p between 2 and 3, the increment and the area, what was in Bruce's talk, the lift to the area, is enough information. So For the sort of things in Brownian motion case, it's enough to give the increment and the area around the, between the path and the chord. And the sign of the area does give you quite a lot of information. One thing I quite like pointing out to show that, again, that it has an effect is, suppose you have a play, a Shakespearean play, and you turn it into a path by moving upwards every time you see a happy word and across every time you see a sad word, and you send all the others to zero. Then if the happy words come first and the sad words come afterwards, we call it a tragedy. If it's the other way around, we call it a comedy. You see, the area really does make a difference. That's just a change in the sign of it. Anyway, so the idea, mathematically, is that rather than recording just a chord, at some very fine scale, it's piecewise smooth. So we go away and compute the area between the path and the chord. And that's a piece of data, in fact, not in the Heisenberg group, but it would be in the Heisenberg group if it were two dimensions. In general, it's in the free two-step nilpotent group. And that's all a rough path is. It's a path in a Carnot group sitting above Rn, with a certain regularity to the path. Now, I could do it all in terms of p-variation, and p-variation is more natural, as was pointed out to me by Jean Bossuin years ago, because it's a metric that's invariant under time reparameterization. And the problem was invariant under time reparameterization. If you roll the sphere along the path more quickly, you just simply do the rotation more quickly. But people seem happy with Holden norms, so that's what I'm going to talk about today. So I want to define a perfectly reasonable down-to-earth metric on my smooth paths, which is a Holden norm with a difference. So if I took away that, that would simply be the Holden norm. Gamma of S minus gamma T over T minus S to the alpha. But I want to include something else in there. I want to include the area between the chord and the path, which is written like that, if it's a smooth path. But let's keep everything homogeneous, so if I scale the path, I don't change the balance between these coordinates, so let's take the square root of it and put that as T minus S to the alpha. Okay, this is a perfectly good metric. And, in fact, it is the Holden norm of the lift of the path into the Heisenberg group with one of the many homogeneous metrics that you might want to choose. Okay, right, well, let's just choose that. That's a perfectly good metric, and that will do as my rough path metric. If you go higher, you have to do more things, and we won't do that. But you can, and there's no problem to do it, it's just that probabilists don't have the background. In fact, as I said, normally I would deal with p-variation rather than Holdenness. P-variation just says you take the sum of increments to a peak power, where p is 1 over alpha. It's almost the same thing in that a function has finite p-variation if and only if it can be reparameterized to have finite Holden norm. So Holden norm is, if you like, the unit speed trajectory through a finite p-variation path. But I'm not going to deal with that, I just put it up to your information. Because most of what I write involves the p-variation, not the Holden norm. But today, we're going to stick firmly with Holder. So now we have a very concrete problem. It's not hard to extend this metric, at least when alpha is less than a half, to a Brownian path, because we can simply take the Levy area as our substitute for the area of our smooth path. So we can write down that norm with no problem. And we can at the same time condition on the uniform norm of B with respect to some norm, which we have to choose, being small. So this is now a problem not about rough paths, but about Holder norms, including Levy areas, of Brownian paths on Rn. And if we can prove that, then we can prove the support theorem. And so what I want to do now is to outline the issues involved in proving this theorem. But as I say, it's much more subtle than it looks. And the first thing to warn you is an old paper of Sujita, where this is a particular norm on path space. It's a sort of L infinity norm, right? We have time, we're taking a super long time of some magnitude in Rn. It's a sort of L infinity, as I've said, there's not one L infinity because we're not in one dimension. There's lots of them according to the norm we choose on our ball in Rn. And it really does matter. But there are lots of them. Well, we could have taken another norm on path space. Any norm on path space which has which captures the Brownian paths. And we could look at the area. Well, Sujita discovered something which shouldn't exist. He found a norm where if we condition the path to have smaller and smaller norm, its area converges in probability to one. So as you make the path smaller and smaller, rather than the area going to zero, it converges off to one. It's a terrible thing to do. But anyway.
That was a finite dimensional norm?
No, it's an infinite dimensional norm on path space. It's a norm on path space. How is the Wiener measure? But if you condition it to be small, so you make the path near zero, you get this. This is how we actually show that the trace onto the onto W12 was not a very good concept in Wiener space. Okay, so the norm is a tricky thing. It's not a totally obvious remark. But what I want to get across is, as I've said it several times now, is that the norm in Rn even matters. It really does, Martin. It really does. And Strook and Baragan in their original paper were only able to do the square, where they took the sup over x and the sup over y. More recently, Mirel Capitan has done the sphere. But it's absolutely not easy. The conditionings are not equivalent. That's what I tried to explain. It's like Onsager-Mutlow functionals. This is really the point. When you condition to be in a very small space, you impose enormous constraints on your path. And it tries very hard to be near the boundary of the domain. But the boundaries are different. So typically, there's no comparability at all on the conditioning processes. And that's, in a sense, part of the guts of it. Because what I'm going to do today is I'm going to explain the proof, I think the first proof, that works for wide class of domains. You don't have to choose, it certainly works for every norm, but thanks to Chris here and the right reference, it works for a lot of other spaces as well. And as I tried to say, the real reason it doesn't work, the real reason it's delicate, is the probability that you're inside a ball of radius epsilon is e to the minus 1 of epsilon squared. And that's a very, very small number. And so it's perfectly easy for these two sets of size e to the minus 1 over epsilon squared to have nothing much in common with each other, even though the balls are comparable with each other. Okay, so let me try and explain the technologies that turn up in the proof. I mean, I probably will not succeed in communicating with you the actual epsilons and deltas of the analysis, but if I can just give you the different ingredients that you're going to put in, then maybe you can put them in yourself. Okay, well, the first thing that one does is one's going to exploit Markov methods. So when I condition a Brownian motion to have a small Holder norm, this is a paper by Tooney and myself some long time ago, you can do all sorts of things, but one thing for sure is it's not Markov. But in the limiting case, in the L infinity case, where you condition the process to stay inside this ball of radius epsilon up to time t, or even up to time infinity, you get a Markov process. It's just the H transform. Either H transformed by the harmonic function that's 1 there and 0 there for the heat equation, or if you carry on forever, by the first eigenfunction times the exponential. So it's a Markov process, and that will help us quite a lot. It's a reversible Markov process, and the nice, easy one to work with is the one where you let the time go to infinity, where it's a time stationary process. So you just let the thing run forever and ever. It has a stationary measure. We know what the stationary measure is. It's just the eigenfunction, and so on and so forth. Okay. So this process has... So now here's where we're beginning to use something about the domain. So that bit doesn't use anything really. It makes sense. It's a Markov process. If we condition to lie in a region, that's not the whoops. Right. So there are some crucial things which I think you'll have an intuition for that matter. So I'm looking at my domain. I'm looking at it, the process over a long time interval. And I'm going to take two events. I'm going to take an event that's entirely contained in the sigma field of the process up to time one, so what we could call a near event. And I'm going to take a far event that is measurable with respect to the process only after time one. Okay, so we have a fixed domain, we're not shrinking it, we're letting time get longer and longer. And I'm going to take these two events, one in the near, one in the far. Well, the claim is that if the event is in the far, it doesn't matter whether we start the process of the origin or with a stationary measure, we get essentially the same probability of the event. That's a boundary Harnack principle required to do that, and Chris has given me sort of hugely general conditions under which they apply, but for sure they apply to the norm, the ball that comes from a norm. The other thing one needs, so that's the far event. The far event, it doesn't matter whether we start at the point or we start with a stationary measure. The near event is something a bit different, that also needs the boundary Harnack to prove, and that is that if we look at the conditional process and look at the probability of A, or the unconditional process and look at the probability of A, then the unconditioned process gives you a control over the probability of A. So if we only look at the near event, the conditioning doesn't really have an effect on one side, it's only a one-sided bound, if we start in the middle of the domain. Okay, two quite intuitive things, which aren't always true, but they are true for a wide class of domains, including the norm ball. Now, the next thing we need is actually much, much closer to what Bruce talked about. Most of you, I guess, know Borel's inequality, Fernick's theorem, the different versions of the statement that if you have a norm on a Gaussian space, so that with positive probability the norm is finite, then in fact there is a Gaussian tail for that norm. Now, we're not looking at that, because although we have defined a norm, the p variation is a norm, our object isn't linear. We took the p variation of the norm and the sort of p over 2 variation of the area. It's a functional on the path and its area. It's a functional on paths, not in Rm, but on paths in the Heisenberg group. And you need the same sort of tail estimate. You see, you still get the r squared there because we took a square root in the area. And that's another reason for doing the homogeneous thing. Well, I would like there to be some soft general theorem. I believe there is a soft general theorem, but I certainly haven't proved it. On the other hand, if you look at the concrete example that we're talking about, it's not too hard to really go away and prove a Gaussian tail estimate. Now, actually, the way we're going to use this Gaussian tail estimate is not over interval of length 1, but an interval of length epsilon squared, and we're going to use that little theorem we had before that said that the conditioned process and the unconditioned process actually do not really have a very different behavior over small timescales. So the unconditioned process, this is the unconditioned process, will give us a good bound on small time intervals using this sort of inequality. But the Gaussian tails are crucial. The other trick we'll need, of a generic sort of kind, involves forward and backward martingales. So if you have a reversible process, we do have a reversible process living in our tube, if we constrain it to be in there forever. And we know it's stationary measure, and the stationary measure is finite, and it doesn't explode, and it doesn't fall out of space in finite time. All things we know. And if we integrate a one form along the path for a fixed interval of time, and we start the process with the stationary measure. So what does starting a Markov process with a stationary measure mean? It means that the inverse, the process run backwards, is also Markov. That's what stationary measure really means. Reversible means it's the same process. And what happens is that when you write down Ito's formula, you discover to your delight that if you take the average of the Ito formula going forwards and the Ito formula going backwards, the second order derivatives cancel, and you discover that you can write this integral as an average of two martingales, One martingale is a martingale with respect to the forward filtration, and one martingale is with respect to the backward filtration. You need some care, because it's only over the fixed time interval. Change the time interval, you'll change the martingales. But nonetheless, you can do this, and it wouldn't be much use to you, as martingales ever are, unless you could control the bracket. But the bracket is actually very simple. It's just, as you might guess from using the ETOS formula to construct each one separately, it's just given by the magnitude of the form squared dt. So if the form is bounded, then we get uniform Gaussian tail estimates for this random variable against the stationary measure. And we'll see that's exactly what we get. So let's just sort of remind ourselves, this is a sort of reminder, it's nothing new on it. We have our path bombing around inside a domain. We have our metric, which has got this normal piece, which we understand, and this slightly more complicated piece to do with area, which isn't too hard to understand, but it's definitely a little less familiar. But now, we see something rather special happens. We have constrained our process to lie inside a ball of radius epsilon. The ball isn't necessarily spherical, but it's inside a ball of radius epsilon. So we know something about this. It's never bigger than 2 epsilon. Okay? So what does that mean? It means if the hole was enormous big and it came from this term, it could only happen if the times are close together. Let's run through that again. I have my path. My path is constrained to lie inside a ball of radius epsilon. If I look at the Holder norm, and if the Holder norm is big, that must have happened, but I must be able to find times that were close together which witnessed this big Holder norm. It's not going to happen because of times far apart. It can't happen because of times far apart. There must be pairs of times that are relatively close together. Now that's really the crux of the matter. The fact that the norm localizes. If the norm is going to be big, there's some small interval on which it is big. It's very important. Unfortunately, it doesn't work for the area. Right? And that's where we're going to have to really do our work. But it simplifies things enormously, and I think it's very much the heart of the matter, that the norm localizes. Before I go on, I just want to introduce notation, because I'll get that up. So if I have d is now just my ball in whatever norm I choose, and I'm just going to call p epsilon the process conditioned to stay inside the epsilon ball for all time. Save my writing D's over there. So here's the main theorem. And actually, as written, it's false. There should be a 1 minus epsilon squared here, or this should be for all time here. So it should be the p epsilon. If I put a p epsilon here, it's a true statement as it stands. Okay, but anyway, the heart of the matter doesn't change. The probability that the rough path metric is big, conditional on the uniform norm of the path being small, has an explicit exponential tail. Remember, alpha is less than a half, so 1 minus 2 over alpha is fortunately less than 1, so it's very positive. So this is something that does get smaller as epsilon goes to 0. In fact, quite a lot smaller. And if you work hard enough, everything could be made uniform. Right. So, the first thing we're going to need is this localization idea that I mentioned on the previous slide. Something went missing there. If the Holder norm is small, there should, and it happens through the path, there are going to be these times that are close together. So I'm going to split the problem. I'm interested in the conditional probability that this rough path metric is large. And I want to split the problem into the case where it's large and there are witnesses that are close to each other, and it's large and there are no witnesses that are close to each other, giving evidence that it's got a big Holder norm. Do you understand what I mean by witnesses? I mean there are a pair of times for which that make this difference big. Okay? So the second case, so this is where there are no nearby witnesses, means that the contribution had to come from the area. It couldn't have come from the path because of the discussion we just said. So there's essentially a different sort of argument here to here. So I want to focus first on this. I want to estimate the probability that the holder norm is big and that there were some close together witnesses to show it. And we'll see how the localization does the argument. The R over 100 is just because I want to do something clever here. And you shouldn't even worry about them at the moment. So, I'm just going to focus on this. The probability that the holder norm is big and there were some times that were close together that enabled this to happen. Well, I want you to look at this term now. Because if there are two times that are within epsilon squared of one another, and if I look at k over k epsilon squared, k plus 1 epsilon squared, k plus 2 epsilon squared, and I keep on going, I can be sure that S and T will both lie in an interval of length 2 epsilon squared, based on one of these integers. So if the norm is big, there'll actually be an integer interval, k epsilon squared up to k plus 2 epsilon squared, where the norm is big. So I can express my bad path as a union of basically 1 over epsilon squared terms, each of which is the probability that the holder norm is big in some little interval. This is why the localization is so important. Well, you've reduced the problem from having some big holder norm to having a big holder norm on 1 of a rather small number of small intervals. But now you can use all the mixing and so on to realize that this norm doesn't depend on time, really. It doesn't depend on k, the mixing and all the rest of it. So you see, you can just see that, in fact, you have 1 over epsilon squared times the probability over a small interval that the holder norm is big. Obviously, that's a very unlikely event because of our tail estimates that we have that followed Bruce's sort of direction of argument. So the Fernique type inequality will kill this off once we take away the k. Okay, so now we're left with the other term, and it's more or less the same idea. You can localize it, but you've got to be a little bit more careful now. So the first thing you've got to use, and this is why I had to introduce those hundreds, is that you can still assume the paths are continuous and regular on small time intervals, because you're assuming that there were no witnesses that were close together that got the holder norm large. Well, as a consequence of that, again, you can actually find the times that are of the form k epsilon squared and l epsilon squared where the holder norm is big. So the idea, again, is you restrict yourself to integers, but now they're far apart. The only constraint you put on them was that they shouldn't be equal. They're separated by at least epsilon squared. So in fact, we don't have 1 over epsilon squared of them now. We have 1 over epsilon to the fourth terms. And they've not all got the same coefficients. Okay, some are longer intervals and some are shorter intervals. And we've got to find some way of estimating these, and that's a bit tricky. That's genuinely a bit tricky. And that's where the forward-backward martingale bit comes in. And it's also where I was very careful not to have 0 there. I started my sum at 1. But I can do that because of the sort of continuity that comes from the assumptions. But it's important to me because then I can replace this 0 by the stationary measure. Now, that doesn't help me so long as I'm looking at these areas, but something else helps me. So this object here is this integral from S to T. And I can turn that into a one-variable process, and normally I get absolutely nowhere. So the area from S to T is, as we said, is this area in here. And normally that area is small, and if we compare it with the area, say, from the difference between that area and that area, we get an error. And that error is the area of a triangle x0, xsst. And normally, that would be a disaster. But under our conditioning, it's not a disaster at all. Because under our conditioning, this error, the area of that triangle, cannot possibly be more than epsilon squared, because these three points are inside the ball. And everything else, when you sit down with a clear head, you're looking at, is of a significantly bigger magnitude, because alpha is less than a half. So the reality is that this doesn't have any effect on the timescales we're interested in. So we can replace AST by simply AT minus AS. Now, why is that a good thing? Well, this is a martingale, normally. But it's not a martingale. If it were a spherical Brownian motion, you could then just say, it's a martingale, and you could be this bracket. And so we'd be using the Holder continuity of Brownian motion, and you could use Fermi's theorem again, and it'd all be easy. It's almost as easy, because you see that's just the integral of a form. It's exactly the case that we're integrating our one form. In this case, the one form is xi dxj minus xj dxi. We're integrating it over a time interval, and we're looking to see if it's big. Well, fortunately, our one form has a uniform bound on it. Now, this thing doesn't normally look bounded. In fact, typically it grows linearly. But that's the point. It's inside a region of size epsilon. Something that 0 at 0 grows linearly, and you restrict it to the ball of size epsilon, has magnitude epsilon. So actually, we get a uniform Gaussian martingale tail estimate for the behavior of these variables. We actually see that the worst case is when those times were close together, not when they were far apart. So we can easily estimate the whole probability by simply taking the L to be k plus 1, and writing that 1 over epsilon to the 4th outside that sum. So that actually gives us a sharp estimate for the tail behavior. And that's it. That's it. Because we've really proved that for any domain for which those mixing properties happen, the probability that the process conditioned to stay inside that domain as you shrink the domain will converge to zero in the rough path metric. You can then turn that into a proof of the support theorem more or less trivially. But it's interesting in its own right. Now, I've run out of time, or run out of slides, I should say, because I guess I've got about maybe 10 minutes. I want it, but I don't really want it. I'm happy to tell you a little bit about a couple of other problems where you get a very concrete representation comes out of it. But maybe people would just want to go and catch their plane, so I think that's probably a better solution. So thank you very much.
Yeah, that's a good question. So, what can I say? Well, this argument would work for any reversible diffusion, not even semi-martingale ones. Uniform in the diffusion divergence form, the paper and Rich Bass, we were able to sort of have an error and all the rest. You could solve differential equations. I'm confident that this little fall back a bit at the end of the day. So the Markov case extends enormously. Okay, and you will still get a support thing. At least from saying it's zero. But more recently, Laurie Kuto and John McGeehan have shown that fractional Brownian motion is a fractional Brownian motion can be used to solve differential equations. So again, you have very sensible support theorem and questions for what sorts of objects do solutions to the SDE approximate. So, now they have proved theorems. Again, they extended their version of the support theorem of the zero dimension. They have proved theorems, a theoretical theorem, and a paper that's just given down like a place ago. proving the support for them using their authorized contents. However, in those cases, I think you really do have to use a correlation content. So basically, the restrictions on the norms become much, much more difficult. Because it's much more Gaussian. This is what I'm trying to show you here, is that there's a Markovian argument that gets you a very long way. The fractional Brownian motion tends to use a Gaussian argument much more heavily. The answers are not necessarily going to be identical. So, but you can do a lot. And the technology, again, focuses you on the real amounts you actually have to do.
Can we go back to the last slide, please? I have a very naive question, probably. Anyway, I can answer it without it go on.
No.
That the xi, xj, minus xj, xi is not a Markov field.
No, it's not.
Okay, so, can you just...
I don't think you'd expect it to be if you didn't have rotational symmetry for the domain.
But the x in the Brownian motion...
The difference is 2 months ago to this other month ago. So why, if your conditions apply in that domain...
Oh, this is for the condition measure.
Yeah. Your condition defines the domain.
With the Rounds metric.
With the Rounds metric, it really is a Martingale, even under the condition.
Right.
And you can really just use classical Martingale estimates. However, this is missing the point. Because even in that domain, you can use classical Martingale estimates.
Yeah.
Without really changing anything else. so this sort of missing point is a cheap argument. It's a bit more surprising, actually, in this domain. So what is the area is basically well mapped out on some fixed points, as you know. It's very obvious in spherical symmetric domain that the area is as likely to become negative as positive as a symmetry to it, and you have a Martingale. It's far less obvious, it's of course not true in this domain, like that. But nonetheless, the errors can't build up. And you can't have a systematic accretion of positive bits or a systematic accretion of negative bits. Because you can write it over the fixed time scale, has a difference of the form is down the form is down here.
So you said somebody did it with a square domain prior to this.
Sorry?
Somebody did it with a square domain. The square.
That was true back on, isn't it?
The original one now.
Because the condition on the x coordinate and the y coordinate set.
So the Lockhart analysis also work for continuous properties, for example, stable.
Easily. There's a paper by a guy who is not the obvious one, but called David Williams, in Revista, where he proves that Levy processes are real parts. In fact, it's easier. Well, it sounds dumb, but in fact, Levy processes are more continuous than that one. They're subordinated to the random parts. What happens is you have a random constant in front of them with a big tail. But the actual individual parts have better recognition. They have jumps. But if you just imagine moving across those rather quickly, add a little bit of extra time, then there's not a problem. Yes, so there's not a problem, but there's one big little thing to do. And the referees rejected this thought in their paper because they didn't understand it. If you want to do what most people do with jumps, they do something which isn't very geometric. If you have an STU with jumps and you have a jump, they just add it. You know, they just move the thing by the jump. It is far more natural to flow along a vector field for that unit of time. That's the geometric coordinates invariant way of doing it. So the correct way to solve these equations is whenever you have a jump, simply pretend that there was a straight line in there. Because remember, you have noises in vector space. And then flow along a vector field. And that produces a nice flow of numerical cells and everything else. Now, if you really wanted to do a jump, you regard that as a perturbation of your original problem. So you first of all find the flow associated with the geometric solution. And that's no problem at all, that completely fits into this. And then on top of that, you make a perturbation to the flow, you know, using the minor solutions of that thing, to give you the correction term, to give you the jump, if you really want to do what you want to do. Yeah, but the whole discussion was time parameterization and bearing. I was very careful to set everything up in a way that didn't matter about time. You roll the sphere along the table, I didn't say how quickly. If you want time in there, you should think of it as an extra variable. If you want to follow what happens in time, you should look at xt, comma t and call that yt. And then you see everything that you want about time. But there are a fair number of problems where you want to be elliptic rather than have wave. For example, we have a theorem that says if you take a path and look at it, lift into all these groups, then it does tell it here what it is as a control. It would be a completely different theorem if it involves time. It would be a mixed set theorem, which is less
interesting.
Well, there's no problem with vector processes. They're more regular than Brownian motion. Unless you try hard, they have a thing, don't feed them every area, they have p variation less than 2.
But SD05 is still probably more complicated than
Brownian motion. Well, not if you read the right papers, isn't it? If I have a smooth path, and I want to understand its t metric distance from other parameters, because I want to look at the closure in p variation, so as I capture ground and balance, for example, what would be the correct metric to put on my paths? Well, I think that's the question, really. And the answer is that you take your path and you lift it to the free end step in your problem group, where n is at least as big as p. It can be as big as you like. If you have a smooth path, you can lift it to all of them. It's just classical geometry. You can take the horizontal lift to all of them. The theorem, if you like, is you don't have to take it further than the first one on in order to have the information you need to solve differential equations. But if it's rougher, it has to be higher up. So the answer is you, the metric is on paths in a color group, in a free Hilbert group. And there are very concrete representations of that in terms of iterated intercourse and things that other people know about. In fact, this is touching on stuff that from an algebraic point of view are equivalent. The algebraic side is a huge industry, it's an enormous number of people have all sorts of things about that. They can't do analysis of it.
If the process would have the boundary types issues, would you also be able to apply the step table?
If it hits the boundary.
Yeah,
the if it is the reflection rather than the
Any kind of boundary.
Okay. Well, that's a good question.
Or even sticky diffusion terms would go along.
But it begins to ask you what you mean by the solution to a differential equation.
Yeah.
Because you can take the differential equations if you get by having normal reflection on the boundary. The x is dw plus the local time on the boundary or something like that. Now, is that actually the solution to a differential equation? Or is it, because you write down the flow, I think this is a good test. If you can write down the flow, then the answer is yes. So if there are strong solutions, and you can find strong solutions from every starting point at the same time, the answer is yes. But if you had used the martingale problem to select one of the different possibilities, which is what martingale problems often do, and tell you, well, there's lots of things you could mean, and you meant that one because that's the only one that has mean zero behavior when it's bouncing off the boundary or whatever, then you definitely can't do it. But this is really about coupling two rough systems.
Okay.
Really not about t trying to dream up new local processes. It's trying to express the fact that things can be related analytically to one another, even when the initial input isn't smooth. Now, the interesting thing, I haven't done it, so I'm not sure, is you don't sell inflections. Initially, we learn how to badly multiply, which were functions that took objects and produced new objects, and that's where they are. But once you've done that, it really makes sense to think about equations. And you have two different ways of producing objects on both sides, and you say that they're going to be equal. And that was quite interesting, actually. I did play with it a little bit on a sort of quadratic function, or a sort of very trivial sort of matter associated sort of thing. And it was interesting. It made sense mathematically, but it had some huge problems. The original problem is the good question, and the answer is not really. It's about the troubles. It's actually a different morphism. It's actually a representation. Some paths form a group, more or less. If I take one part in the vector space and then another, we can capture it. When we solve the differential stochastic differential equation, we can construct a quad, don't we? So we construct a diffeomorphism of a manifold to itself, which you can sort of think as a group on. In fact, when you think about it, it's a homomorphism, isn't it? Because if we solve it along one part segment from another, then what do we get? We get the composition of it. So in fact, what we're doing is infinite dimensional Cartan development. That's really what we're doing. I'm understanding. And if you have a linear map of the algebras, you can turn it into a homomorphism.
Well,
I
disagree with you about that. I want to go back to the philosophy of jump processes, and I have to say that I have a big problem with it. You see, that point of jump processes is that they have jumps. And a jump is something that happens instantaneously. Of course, you can kill jumps with line segments, but there is no canonical way to connect two points, two endpoints of a single jump.
But you couldn't tell us
about that. In any difficult situation when you want to do integration or something, there's any information.
SDs are coupling. So you've got to tell me how the system responds to the jump. The minute you do that, I have no problem. It doesn't matter that it happens over instantaneously in time. The system presumably has to respond instantaneously as well. And so unless you tell me how the system responds to the jump, I could represent that probably as the solution of the differential equation is instantaneously over time. And there has to be a map that tells you how to go from jumps to jumps.
It's not correct.
Sure.
You
need
more information.
Just remember, if I take a path, remember p variations, parameterization there. Okay? It's a sub over the increments over all possible partitions, because no matter how I parameterize it, I don't change them. Okay? Now just notice that if I take my path with jumps and put in straight line segments, it doesn't change the variation. So it doesn't increase it iota. There is essentially no difference between the path with the jumps and the path with the straight line segments in the vector space. And you have to tell me, you're going to have to MSP, a sense of what the terminal jumps into evolution in the state space. Now most state spaces are not linear, they're navigable. So you should give me a geometrically invariant way of doing that. You've got to give me a geometrically invariant way of telling me, if I'm here and a jump happens, where am I going to end up? And it's 9 times out of 10 you want to do that by writing down a differential equation. You could just have a transfer function, that's what people do, and it screws you up. You don't get flows anymore, and that's it. You've set the
coordinate. Any more comments? Okay, so I'll just thank everybody.